Chapter 5. The furnace-like atmosphere cooled slightly as the fading sun fell to the west beyond the Thassos Mountains. Long, crooked shadows from the mountains' tree-lined summits had moved down the slopes and were touching the seaward edge of Brady Field when Pitt passed through the main gate. He stopped on the outer road and inhaled the pure Mediterranean air, enjoying the inner sensation of having his lungs tingle. The habitual call for a cigarette tugged at his mind, but he pushed the urge aside and took another deep breath, looking out to sea. Beyond the rolling surf, the setting sun painted the first attempt a colorful golden orange. The visibility was crystal clear, and at a distance of 2 miles his eyes could pick out an amazing amount of detail on board the ship. He stood quiet and still for almost a full 2 minutes, lost in the beauty of the scene. Then he glanced about, looking for the car that Terry promised to send for him. It was there, sitting off to one side of the road like a palatial and sumptuous yacht resting at anchor. "Well, I'll be damned," Pitt muttered, spotting the car. He moved closer, and his face betrayed an admiration for fine automobiles. It was a Maybach Zeppelin town car, complete with a sliding glass partition separating the enclosed passenger compartment from the driver, who sat in the open exposed to the sun. Behind the large double M ornament on the radiator, the hood stretched back 6 feet and ended at a low split windshield, giving the car an image of great brutish power. The long flowing fenders and running boards gleamed black, but the coachwork was painted a deep, multi-coated silver. It was a classic among classics, superb Teutonic craftsmanship evident in every fitting, every nut and every bolt. If the 1936 Rolls-Royce Phantom III typified the British ideal of silence and distinguished mechanical efficiency, then its German counterpart was found in the 1936 Maybach Zeppelin. Pitt stepped up beside the car and ran his right hand over a gargantuan spare tire that sat solidly mounted in the front fender well. He grinned a grin of satisfaction and relief as he noted the tire's tread was deeply grooved in a diamond-shaped pattern. He patted the big donut-like tire a couple of times and then turned and looked into the front seat. The driver sat slouched behind the wheel, idly drumming his fingers on the doorframe. He not only looked bored, but he yawned to prove it. He was dressed in a gray-green tunic that strangely resembled the uniform of a World War II Nazi officer, but the sleeves and shoulders bore no insignia. A high-brimmed cap covered his head, and the blonde color of his hair was betrayed by the brief hint of his sideburns. Old-fashioned, silver-rimmed spectacles covered his eyes and glinted in the setting sun. A long, thin cigarette dangled conceitedly from one corner of a curled lip, giving the driver an aura of smugness and arrogance, an image he made little effort to conceal. Pitt instantly disliked the driver. Putting a foot on the running board, he stared penetratingly at the uniformed figure behind the steering wheel. "I think you're waiting for me. My name is Pitt." The yellow-haired driver did not bother to return Pitt's stare. He merely flipped his cigarette over Pitt's shoulder onto the road, sat up straight, and turned the ignition switch. "If you are the American garbage receiver," he said in a heavy German accent, "you may get in." Pitt grinned and his eyes hardened. "Up front with the foul-smelling rabble, or in back with the gentry?" "Wherever you choose," the driver said. His face turned crimson, but he still did not turn or look up. "Thank you," said Pitt smoothly. "I'll take the back." He pushed down on a huge chrome handle, swung the vault-like door open, and climbed into the town car. An old roll-style curtain perched over the partition window, and Pitt pulled it down, closing off all sight of the driver in front. Then he settled back comfortably into the soft and luxurious Morocco leather upholstery, lit a cigarette, and prepared to enjoy the early evening ride across Thassos. The Maybach's engine quietly came to life, and the driver shifted through the whisper-silent gears, moving the immense car over the road in the direction of Leminas. Pitt rolled down a door window and studied the fir and chestnut trees dotting the mountain slopes, and the age-old olive trees lining the narrow beaches. Every so often, small fields of tobacco and wheat broke the uneven landscape and reminded him of the small farms he had often seen when flying over the southern United States. Soon the car cruised through the picturesque village of Panagia, splashing an occasional puddle that marred the elderly cobbled streets. Most of the houses were painted white to reflect the summer heat. The roofs rose into the fading sky and nearly touched as their eaves leaned toward each other over the narrow streets. In a few minutes Panagia was left behind, and Laminas soon came into view. Then the car abruptly turned, skirting the main section of the little city, and pointed its dinosaurian hood up a dusty cliff road. The incline was gradual at first, but quickly wormed into a series of steep hairpin curves. Pitt could sense the driver struggling at the wheel of the Maybach. The lumbering town car was designed more for casual rides on the Unter den Linden than spring-breaking tours up mule trails. He looked over sheer precipices at the sea and wondered what would happen if another car came from the opposite direction. Then he could see it ahead, a huge white square against the darkening gray cliffs. At last the curves ceased and the big diamond-treaded tires slid smoothly onto the hard surface of a drive. Pitt was adequately impressed. In size, the villa nearly matched the splendor of a Roman forum. The grounds were well kept and there was an atmosphere of wealth and good taste. The entire estate nestled in a valley between two high mountain peaks and overlooked a sweeping panorama of the Aegean Sea. The main gate of a high wall opened mysteriously, apparently pulled by someone unseen, and the chauffeur drove up a neat, fur-lined drive without ceremony and braked at a flight of marble steps. In the center of the stairway, a large, archaic statue of a woman carrying a child stared down mutely, greeting Pitt as he stepped from the Maybach. He started to climb the steps when he stopped suddenly and returned to the car. "I'm sorry, driver," said Pitt, "but I didn't catch your name." The driver looked up, puzzled. "My name is Willie. Why do you ask?" "Willie, my friend," Pitt said seriously, "I must tell you something. Will you step out of the car for a moment?" Willie's brows wrinkled, but he shrugged and stepped from the car, facing Pitt. "Now, Herr Pitt, what do you wish to tell me?" "I see you wear jackboots, Willie." "Yeah, I wear yak boots." Pitt flashed his best used car salesman smile. "And jack boots have hobnails, don't they?" "Yeah, yak boots have hobnails," said Willie irritably. "Why do you waste my time with such nonsense? I have duties to perform. What is it you wish to say?" Pitt's eyes grew hard.
"My friend, I felt that if you want to earn your Peeping Tom merit badge, it's my duty to warn you that silver-rimmed spectacles reflect the sun's rays and can easily give your hiding place away." Willie's face went blank, and he started to say something, but Pitt's fist slammed into his mouth, cutting off the words. The impact jerked Willie's head up and back, throwing his cap in the air. His eyes turned dull and empty, and he slowly swayed like a falling leaf to his knees. He knelt there, looking dazed and lost. A stream of bloody mucus dropped from his broken nose and splattered over the lapels of his uniform, creating what Pitt thought a rather artistic effect against the gray-green material. Then Willie pitched forward onto the marble steps and folded into an inert heap. Pitt rubbed the knuckles of his bruised hand, grinning in cold satisfaction. Then he turned and jogged up the steps, taking three at a time. At the top, he passed through a stone archway and found himself in a circular courtyard with a glass-like pool in its center. The entire courtyard was encircled by 20 or more majestic, life-sized statues of helmeted Roman soldiers. Their sightless stone eyes somberly stared at their white reflections in the pool, as if searching for long-forgotten memories of victorious battles and wars of glory. The deepening shadows of evening covered each figure with a ghostly cloak, giving Pitt the weird sensation that at any second the stone warriors would come alive and lay siege to the villa. He hurried around the pool and stopped at a massive double door at the far end of the courtyard. A large bronze knocker in the shape of a lion's head hung grotesquely on the door. Pitt raised the grip, banging it down hard. He turned and glanced at the courtyard again. The entire setting reminded him of a mausoleum. All it lacked, he thought, were a few scattered wreaths and some organ music. The door swung open silently. Pitt peered across the threshold. Seeing no one, he hesitated a moment. The moment turned into a minute, and the minute into two. Finally, tiring of hide-and-seek, he braced his shoulders, clenched his fists, and stepped through the portal into an ornately decorated anteroom. Tapestries depicting ancient battle scenes hung from every wall, their needlework armies marching in unison toward battle. A high dome capped the room, and from its arched apex came a soft yellowish light. Pitt glanced around and saw that he was alone, so he sat down in one of two carved marble benches that adorned the middle of the room, and he lit a cigarette. Time passed, and soon he began a futile search for an ashtray. Then, silently, with no warning, a tapestry swung aside, and an old, heavy-set man entered the room, accompanied by an immense white dog.